Dave Dawson lay on his back, fingers laced behind his head for a pillow, and lazily watched white patches of cloud play tag with each other at some 18,000 feet over England. It was the 10th day of September, 1940, and the most glorious summer the British had experienced in 40 years was still very much in evidence. The sun was a brassy ball in the heavens that flooded the earth with a warm, comforting glow. The birds, the bees, and the butterflies were all around, and the emerald green of the surrounding landscape gave him the feeling that the snow and the cold of winter were two things that would never be experienced in England again. A perfect summer day. The warm sun, the singing birds, the flowers in bloom, and the war. 20 miles across the English Channel, less than 3 minutes by air, Nazi hordes were working day and night toward that great moment when their leader, Adolf Hitler, would give them the order to begin their attempted invasion of England. And on this side of that channel, some 40-odd millions of people were also working day and night, so that when the order was given, not a single German booted foot would succeed in touching English soil. A beautiful summer day, and the people of the greatest empire on earth were waiting, ready to fight and die to the last man that their freedom might survive. "Well, Pilot Officer Dave Dawson of His Majesty's Royal Air Force," a voice suddenly broke in Dave's ear, "I'll give you a penny for your thoughts. No, wait, let me guess. You were thinking about your home in Boston, Massachusetts, back in the States." Dave sat up and grinned down at the good-looking, sun-bronzed youth sprawled out on the grass at his side. He shook his head and held out his hand. "Wrong, Pilot Officer Freddie Farmer of the same Royal Air Force," he said. "So, pay me the penny. I was thinking that it sure is one swell day. And I was wondering if we were going to get a little action, or if Hitler had found out we were now regular active service pilots and decided to call off the war." "Oddly," the English youth said with a chuckle. "True, he's probably scared stiff now that you and I are in the RAF. I fancy, though, he isn't that scared. But it's pretty wonderful, isn't it? I mean, to be in the RAF." Dave didn't answer. He let his gaze wander over to the line of Supermarine Spitfires powered with 1,030-horsepower Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, just looking at those swift, powerful birds. Man-made metal birds of war made his heart start pounding, and the blood surged through his body. An honest-to-goodness Spitfire pilot in the Royal Air Force. It was like living in a wonderful dream, and it was doubly wonderful because it was true. The training and the concentrated study were all behind Freddy and himself now. Each wore the highly prized wings above the upper left pocket of his tunic. But perhaps even more important was the fact that they'd already received their baptism of fire. Each had got himself a German plane, the first payment in return for the training and instruction England had given them. For a month now, they'd been stationed with number 207 squadron. The hotel rocked and shook violently, and there was the tinkle of glass as the shattered windows spilled into the room. They waited until the echo of the explosions had died away, and then got slowly to their feet. There was a hole just now where the window had been, a hole that looked out on a world gone suddenly mad with roaring sound and flashing red, orange, and yellow flame. Freddy groped for Dave's hand and shook it warmly. "Thanks, thanks very much," he said in a tight voice. "Thanks for what?" Dave said. "For reminding me to keep away from windows during a bombing raid," Freddy said. "But just before that blighter scared 10 years off my life, what were you saying? Oh, yes, you want to go up on the roof." "Sure," Dave said with a nod, "for a look. We'll be as safe there as any place. If one's coming, it'll come. Just standing here waiting gives me the creeps anyway." "Me too," Freddy agreed. "Let's go then. But the manager's in the air raid shelter, though, and won't dig up 10 helmets for us for love of money." "Well, we can try," Dave said. "Drop, Freddy. Here comes another." Dave's words of warning were just a waste of breath. The screaming whistle of that bomb hurtling downward cut through all sound. As Dave flung himself flat again, he had the crazy feeling of listening to some huge, invisible giant tearing off the top of the world. Even the anti-aircraft battery close to the hotel was drowned out by the unearthly sound of that falling bomb. Then it struck, and the hotel seemed to rise straight up in the air. Dave was sure he could feel the floor heave under him. On the rear wall of one room was a framed picture of King George and Queen Elizabeth. Everything else in the room was wrecked beyond possible recognition by its owners. But the picture of the king and queen was untouched. It hung on the blast-scorched wall as straight as it could be. Something about that picture hanging there touched a deep note in Dave Dawson. He stared at it for a moment in almost reverent awe. Then, clicking his heels, he brought up his hand in smart salute. "There'll always be an England," he murmured softly. Freddie Farmer caught the direction of his gaze, looked himself, and saluted in turn. "Always," with a deep tenderness in his voice. At that moment, a shrill cry of pain came to them from out of the burning building. There was a second cry and a third. They could see nothing but the fierce glow of the flames, but cries seemed to come from the rear of the fourth floor. "There are wounded people in that building," Freddie cried. "Trapped and probably can't get out," Dave added, "and it's a cinch their cries can't be heard by the fire wardens down there in the street. What say, Freddie?" "Of course," the English youth shouted, and they were bounding out the door. The elevators had stopped running, so they went down the stairs, three and four at a time. They dashed through the vacant lobby, out the front door, and along the short court that led out onto the Strand. He sent the free end of the coil spinning downward, then knelt down and fastened his end tight about the base of the railing post. "Got it!" he heard the fire lieutenant's voice, and felt a jerk on the rope at the same time. At the end of 3 or 4 minutes, Freddie and the fire lieutenant were on the door landing with him. The fire lieutenant reached out and squeezed his arm. "Stout fella," the man said. "But you're RAF, so of course you'd do it. Righto. This is the fourth floor. The rear, you said. Don't hear a sound. There doesn't seem to be much fire up here. Guess just the front of this place is burning. Try the doors, lads, but be careful if you push them open. Do it easy like, you know. If the room's burning and the windows are closed, opening the door will be like opening a stove flue. Hold your breath till you're sure. Let's go." The three of them started down the hall toward the rear, carefully opening doors and glancing into rooms as they went along. Not a light was burning in the building, but the glow of the flame seemed to bounce back from the walls of nearby buildings and light up all the rooms. Dave and Freddie had tried some 6 or 7 rooms, and suddenly they looked into a room that made them stop short and catch their breath. The room was a complete wreck. It was as though that one spot had received the full impact of the exploding bomb. All 4 walls were completely knocked down. Ribbons of plaster hung from the ceiling, and there weren't any windows, just gaping holes through which streamed the crimson reflection of the flames of another burning building, a good 2 blocks away. It was not the sight of all that, however, that gave them such a start. It was the sight of the 4 figures trapped under the pile of debris. There were 3 men, and 1 was a woman. 2 of the men and the woman lay limp and motionless. The 4th man, white with plaster from head to foot, was struggling furiously to wiggle out from under an overturned desk that was pinning him to the floor. And all the time he was muttering hoarsely under his breath. He saw Dave and Freddy about the same instant they saw him. He stopped struggling immediately. "Come in, chaps, and get this blasted thing off my back, will ya?" he called out. Dave waited just long enough to shout to the fire lieutenant and then dashed forward. It took every bit of their combined strength for Freddie and him to lift the desk clear. They succeeded, however, and the pinned man was able to crawl free. He got to his feet and swayed. Dave gave him a hand. "Steady does it, sir," he said. "I'll lead you into the hall." The trapped man looked at him out of dazed eyes, mumbled something, and nodded. Dave led him out into the hall and then went back to the room again. Freddie and the fire lieutenant were lifting ceiling and wall beams off the woman. He pitched in and gave them a hand. The woman had an ugly cut on the side of her head, and 1 arm was obviously broken. She was breathing evenly, however. They placed her in the hall, then went back in for the other 2 men. Both of them were still alive, but badly hurt. No sooner had they carried the last man out into the hall than there was a rumbling sound, like a New York subway train coming along the tunnel to a station. The fire lieutenant let out a yell and grabbed wildly for Dave, who was the last to step out of the room. "Fid this," he shouted. "Jump!" Dave jumped instinctively. Then he started to speak, but didn't. It was not necessary for him to ask the fire lieutenant what it was all about. As he turned, he saw the floor of the room he had just left split straight through the middle from hall door to outer wall. The floor cracked open, then the 2 halves dropped downward like the 2 halves of a hinged trap door. Broken furniture, plaster, brick, and everything else went crashing down into a room on the 3rd floor. The rumbling roar ceased abruptly, and a great column of smoke and plaster dust fountained up from the floor below.